Hi, I'm Kent Angen, and this is episode 27 of What's It Like? My guest is Gwen Lewis in Meridian, Idaho. How are things in Idaho?
Oh, Idaho's great. It was snowing yesterday, which is nice for us. We moved here from California, so we're still getting used to the weather.
I live in California, so I don't have to get used to the weather. You didn't grow up in Idaho, I gather.
No. Our daughter moved here and had a baby, so we figured if we're going to see the baby, we're going to need to be close. And my work, all I need is an airport, internet connection, and industrial strength prayer.
Where did you grow up, Gwen?
I was born in Ohio, kind of grew up in California.
And from your experience, what would you say? What's it like being a child?
Well, I had my parents were divorced. I was always a troublemaker, living on the edge. I always like getting in trouble. So my childhood was a little bit challenging, to say the least. Of course, I didn't grow up in a Christian home, so that probably has a lot to do with it. Yeah, I got in all kinds of trouble as a youth.
How'd your parents impact your view, then, of yourself or your world around you? Did they help you get in trouble or help you get out of trouble or...
Well, my father was pretty much not around, and I guess they didn't actually get divorced until I was around 14 or 15. So it was pretty much, living with a working mother, which gave me a lot of opportunity to do the kind of stuff I was interested in, drinking, smoking dope. I was arrested for the first time at 15. Yeah, and it was for a petty thievery. Stole a carton of cigarettes from a store.
And did you get more proficient at your craft?
I did. Very, really proficient, yeah. I somehow made it through high school. I always say that my goal in high school was getting a higher number on the ACTs than my blood alcohol level.
How old were you when you started drinking?
Oh, high school. Managed to get out of high school, but then college was on and off. I got drafted and decided that it's probably better for me to be in college than to be in Vietnam. So I signed up to go to college. And at that time, if you were in college, you got a deferment.
Mm-hmm.
So I missed that. Then I dropped out of college and got drafted again and was in a motorcycle accident and was in the hospital. So they gave me another deferment.
This is in the 60s?
Yeah, yeah. Then I got better and got drafted again, but I was in prison. So I said, hey, I'll go. Let's do it. Yeah, Vietnam's not bad.
And they declined, I gather.
Of course, then they didn't want me at all.
Yes, good figure. So how did you get from, how did you survive childhood?
Yeah, I survival, I think, is a little heavy term. I got through it pretty much on my own, but getting in trouble. I ended up with a pretty good drug problem, smoked a lot of marijuana. This was in the early 60s, in 63. Moved to Greenwich Village in New York and lived there for about a year. And then we got a couple of Volkswagen buses and painted them.
Oh.
Yeah, we left buckets of paint on the street next to the van and I just asked people to do whatever they wanted. And the whole van ended up being painted.
Ah, love and child.
Then we stuffed it full of freaks and drove to California. He drove to San Francisco. Yeah, we stopped in northern Nebraska and ate peyote with the Indians. And yeah, and ended up in San Francisco, Haight-Ashbury.
Well, it was the 60s.
I've been sober for, 30 years.
When you look at that now in a more sober mind frame, was that a fun experience or just really stupid?
Oh, yeah, it was great. We had a ball. All I really wanted to do was have fun. That was kind of the whole motivation of the people of the 60s. We just wanted to have fun. we saw what our parents were doing and working their fingers to the bone, and you know, we just rejected all that. And so we just wanted to have fun. Problem was, stuff we were doing for fun is what got us into trouble. The stuff we saw as fun, drugs and sex and, you know, all that stuff, ended up being worse than anything our parents ever got into.
So what changed?
Oh, gosh. You know, I was I went to prison for drugs, for marijuana, down in New Mexico.
You went to prison for trafficking?
Well, I was trafficking, but they didn't catch me trafficking. They got me for possession.
I see.
I had just sold 80 kilos of grass in California, and I was on my way back to New York to visit friends, and got pulled over by the highway patrol in New Mexico. So they got me for two joints.
Wow. Oh.
But I got 10 years for it.
Well, that's quite a sentence.
Yeah, it was pretty grim. I had a lawyer that had been out of law school for about 10 minutes and court appointed. The guy used to come to my cell and just be beside himself. They can't do this. They just can't do it. And they did it, you know. The district attorney was pretty well committed to keeping the hippie freaks out of their state.
I see.
Or letting them stay.
Yes.
All right. I always tell people I lived in New Mexico for a couple of years as a guest of the Secretary of State.
Well, there you go. I didn't know that they were that friendly.
It was free, too, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. What did you do when you got out of prison?
I was on parole. And so I, of course, violated my parole immediately and went back to San Francisco. Except now we were in Berkeley because San Francisco, the hate had pretty much degenerated by that time. So we were all living in Berkeley. And I decided to leave the U.S. because I was paranoid. There was an arrest warrant out for me for parole violation. So I was a wanted criminal. And so I decided to just leave, went to South America.
And was that a good move?
Well, you know, looking back on it, I'm glad. Now, I'm not so sure how good any of my decisions were back in those days, but I went. It was kind of funny when I left the U.S. at that time, they weren't letting long-haired people into Mexico. So I bought a wig and got a short hair haircut on the wig. Pretty funny.
It didn't cut your hair?
Right. I covered it with a wig and then got the wig a haircut.
Okay.
And I was with a girl I had met in Berkeley, the two of us. So we took a train to Mexico City and then bought tickets to South America, to the only country that didn't require a round-trip ticket because we didn't have enough money for both ways. And that had to be Ecuador.
So Ecuador.
Yeah, so we moved to Ecuador. And we were there for, I think all in all, we were there for around 5 years. And I was cooking cocaine, buying from the Indians in the jungle and processing it and then selling it to people who had come from the U.S. and Europe.
So in the good sense, you were a manufacturer?
Yeah.
In a bad sense, you were a drug lord?
Yeah, except we didn't get into all the guns. I had a bodyguard towards the end because it was pretty dangerous, but I never carried a gun. He did, but I didn't. But, you know, we didn't go around killing cops and stuff like that. We were still flower children. We just were trying to survive and be happy. And that, of course, I ended up in prison again down there. Quite a bit different, though.
Not as good.
In some ways, yeah. I was tortured when I was first arrested. Mm. You know, I hung up by my thumbs backwards, you know, my hands behind my back, thumbs tied together, and hung me from the ceiling, beat me with a board.
Why did they torture you?
They wanted to find out who my connections were, where I was buying.
And you didn't tell them?
I did. Well, I made up a bunch of stuff. It was pretty disjointed. But then they just wanted me to sign a confession. And so I didn't want to do that. But they brought my wife in. Well, she's my wife now, but she was my girlfriend then. We also had a baby. It was a year and a half old. It was also in prison. We weren't in the same place. I was in one place, and my wife and kid were in another place. They brought my wife in, and they said they were going to hang her. So I said, okay, I'll sign. Yeah. Because it's important for them because of their justice system. Yeah, it's Napoleonic. You're guilty until proven innocent. And if you confess, it's pretty much of a slam dunk for them. They don't have to spend a lot of time on you. And so I did. I signed it. And then they let her go and put me into a different prison. And I was there for about 18 months.
This doesn't sound like a good story so far.
It's got a good ending, though. Has happy ending.
Oh, good. That's all. Well, then I'll stay tuned.
It was grim, though. It was really grim. I was 18 months without taking a bath. And we were in a place that was just overcrowded. It was wood, made out of wood. And the walls were adobe, but the floors and the ceilings were all wood. So there were rats everywhere. They used to jump up on our beds at night. And it was really, really bad. Guys killing each other and stealing from each other. And yeah, it's just really grim. And but it was during that time that a missionary began to visit us. I say us. My wife was kicked out of the country, but she snuck back in to try to take care of me because you have to feed yourself in there. They don't feed you. And so she snuck back into the country. And she was living in a pension down the street, and I was in the prison. And a missionary started to visit us and eventually shared the Lord with us. And November 12th, 1974, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I received Christ and changed my life.
That's a very specific time for you.
It was. Yeah, it was one of those, you know, way up. It's like turning on a light switch. Like I was walking around in the dark, and all of a sudden, everything made sense.
Many people listening to this will not have had that kind of belief system or experience in their life. So what is that like for you?
Well, for me, I was a total pagan. I mean, I didn't know anything about the Lord. I didn't know anything about my family. I never went to church. I'd never been to Sunday school. You know, I didn't know anything about anything. All I knew is that God was real and that he really cared about my wife and I and our child. Mm-hmm. And that you know, he spoke to me. And it doesn't happen to everybody. Everybody comes on a different path. Some are like instantaneous, like mine. Others are step by step getting closer and closer. Others are raised in Christian homes. For me, that's a bigger miracle than what happened to me. If you're raised in a Christian home and you grow up with really good values and make really good decisions, that's a bigger miracle than God coming to some idiot in prison somewhere. I love those testimonies. Boy, those really get me, you know, juiced.
So you had this emotional, spiritual turning point in your life.
Yeah. It was, of course, I was at the bottom of the barrel. You know, I was at the end of the rope, as they say. It was, couldn't have been worse.
And you immediately got out of jail and everything turned good.
Not really. but I was set free in prison, but feeling freer than I had ever felt in my life. Because everything made sense, you know?
Right. So it was a big change inside your head.
Yeah. It was amazing. I mean, it was like, doing drugs, you're always talking and you're sitting around doing drugs with people and just talking about whatever comes up. We talked about religion a lot. You know, we talked about Buddhism and yoga and all that stuff. You know, we're searching for meaning. You know, we just had no answers. And all of a sudden it just became just crystal clear to me. And the message I got from God wasn't like a spoken voice, but it was a message from God. What he told me was, if you give it all to me, I'll take care of you. And I like that option. And so I just turned it all over. It was amazing because I was in prison, right? My wife lived in a pension down the street. I was afraid to tell her what happened because we had never talked positively about God or about church. We thought, you know, missionaries were robbing the culture of the people. And yeah, it was something we'd never, ever talked about in a good way. Mm-hmm. So when this happened to me, I was afraid to tell her. And I waited 3 days and finally I sent her a note. Because we didn't see each other during the week. We only saw each other on the weekends. And so I sent her a note because she would bring food to me. And we had this one pot that the handle would unscrew. And you take the handle off and you put messages inside the hollow handle, you know. So we would communicate through the dirty dishes. And so I, like the man that I am, I wrote her a note and sent it out with the dirty dishes. Next day, I got called down to the warden's office. And the only time you ever get called to the warden's office is for a family emergency, right? And so I thought, oh, no, she's leaving. She's thinking I went crazy. And, you know, so I was really, really nervous. And I got there. Turns out, same thing had happened to her. Hmm. And she was afraid to tell me. She was in her pension. You know, it's a little room where she shares a bathroom with 40 people with the baby. And she was reading Good News for Modern Man. Well, she wasn't reading it. She was looking at the stick figure drawings. And God spoke to her, too. Same day, but different place.
But different experience for you as well from her.
Yeah, yeah. It was just a little different. Yeah, but God spoke to her, too. And, yeah, it was amazing. And that just really confirmed to me that what happened to me was real.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
So what did you put in the note? God spoke to me?
I just told her. I decided to give my life to Jesus Christ. See, the missionary, I had a lot of time to read, right? And so he was like bringing me books in English, and he stuck a Bible in there.
Sneaky.
Yeah, he also had a couple of tracts, like he would put them in as bookmarks, you know?
Yes.
And so after the Lord spoke to me, I remembered this one book that had a track in it. And so I read the track, and that's, you know, I read about some guy in an airplane, and he shares the Lord with a guy in the next seat, and you know, the guy receives Christ, and then there's this little prayer on the back, and I filled it out with the date, wrote my name in there, you know. Guys in my prison cell thought I was crazy because I was on my knees, you know, by the side of my bed weeping, filling out this little piece of paper. So they thought I really did crack up, which wasn't uncommon where I was, right? But yeah, it was earth-shattering. But God knew that I needed time. So I was 6 more months in prison after I got saved. And it was good because, you know, I read the Bible cover to cover twice in that time. I mean, I read all the footnotes. I read the maps. I mean, I read everything. I couldn't get enough.
Well, certainly had the time to do it.
Yeah, I had the time, you know. And then the missionaries were discipling us, and you know, some of the missionary community started bringing us food. Food was a real big deal for us because biggest concern was eating. And so they started bringing food. And it was really, really neat. I got to meet some of the missionaries. And the guy that was sharing with us brought his family into the prison. This is before I got saved, right? On visiting day, you come into the prison, into the cell. I mean, this place was gross. There's bugs, and, you know, I was nasty, and it was really bad. And he brought his whole family, and I couldn't believe it. I said to my wife, I said, man, this guy nuts. What are you doing bringing his kids in here? But it really meant a lot to me. And so that was, you know, that was part of the pre-Christian experience, was seeing how God worked.
What happened after your conversion experience then, and you got out of jail?
Well, I was guilty, right? That's the hardest part, because I thought, oh, now I'm a Christian, I got to confess. But I was guilty. I did what they say I did. And the missionary began to act as my lawyer, because my lawyer did not. All he did was take all of our money and leave us stranded. Whatever money was left after the cops got done, they took most of it. And so the missionary was going to the judge and, you know, doing all those things to try to get me a sentencing. Mm-hmm. The sentencing was in the hands of the judge. And I had an option. They were asking for 12 years. And 12 years in that place is like a death sentence. I don't think I could have lived through 12 years. It was really, really difficult. And but if we could convince the judge that I was an addict and that I had been rehabilitated by their wonderful prison system, I could get off with 6 years. And it was pretty gross, but, you know, I think I could have made 6 years. It would have been hard, but, you know, I think I probably could have at least lived through it, you know. And so we were praying for, you know, for the judge to pass sentence. And so right before Easter, the judge decides to take up my case. And so he tells the missionary, okay, let's go to the police warehouse. You know, we'll review the evidence. He had a whole sheet of what was taken from my house, you know, all the chemicals and the glass tubing and cookers, and had a bunch of marijuana and a bunch of hashish. And oh man, it was grim. And he had a list of all that stuff, right? But he said, I got to see it before I can pass sentence. So they go down to the warehouse, the police warehouse, and they opened up the evidence boxes, and they were all empty. There was nothing there. There was nothing. They were empty. I mean, the boxes were there, but there was nothing in them. And so I'm like a fool. I'm back in jail praying for 6 years, right? And my wife comes that afternoon with my freedom, with the piece of paper that set me free.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was released after only a year and a half.
But a year and a half without ever having a trial or a judgment of any kind.
Right, right. Everything's done, you know, by the judge. He decides, well, you're guilty until you can prove yourself innocent. Mm-hmm. If you can prove yourself innocent, they'll let you go. But
right. So there's no hurry to get you to trial.
No hurry at all. Take their time. Yeah. Yeah. It's a whole different system there. Some parts of it are better. I've served in U.S. and abroad, and some of the things, the conditions were bad.
Yes.
But you had quite a bit of freedom. Like I worked. I had to work in order to buy food. I made things out of leather, and then I'd give them to my wife, and she'd take them out and sell them. She'd go to the tourist areas and sell it, you know, sell stuff to the gringos. And we would use that for her to buy food and prepare it, and then send it to me in the jail. And you know, you have a little bit more of freedom inside than you do in the U.S. Mm-hmm. But it's the conditions that are the worst part. It's grim. Yeah, it's really grim.
So what happened once you got out?
Yeah, we found ourselves free. I couldn't believe it. We had our baby was three then, and we had a basket full of clothes and a mattress, and that was, you know, pretty much what we had. And we had had cars and money, you know, from that old drug life. But it was all taken from us, and, you know, we didn't have any carryover from the old life. And so, you know, we got out and came back to the U.S. And I finished my college, went to seminary, got a Master of Divinity, and then went back to South America as missionaries.
How did you decide to go to seminary?
Well, I figured with my background, I had to do something that would legitimize me, right? You can't expect a mission agency to pick up an ex-convict, you know.
Do you feel like people who go through a similar experience, this kind of dramatic conversion, that they are required to become ministers or missionaries?
No, not at all. I mean, everybody's different, but we really felt that what God did for us, he did for a reason. And that there is no going back to normal. And like, you know, when I violated my parole down in New Mexico, I had a fugitive warrant.
Right.
How could I go back to the U.S. with a warrant? I mean, they don't go away. They last forever. There's no statute of limitations on that, on the warrant. And so I had to finish off my 10-year sentence plus another sentence for the violation of parole. And so, but we decided that I'd do whatever I needed to do to be able to go back and get some training. And so I had my mother call the district attorney's office in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. This is before we were still in Ecuador. So I had her call the district attorney's office in New Mexico to ask the district attorney what I would have to do to get my record cleaned. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think I could probably go to prison and do college work from prison and maybe do a couple of years. And you know, after being in Ecuador, the prison in Ecuador, I could do time in the U.S. standing on my head, man. It's like going on vacation, you know? And so my mother called the district attorney's office in New Mexico. And it's a small little town. And so she got the secretary and told the secretary who she was. And they connected her to the district attorney. And the district attorney goes, "Oh, Mrs. Lewis, it's me, Mr. Runyon. He was my lawyer. He had become the district attorney." And she said, well, what would he have? She explained to him what had happened. And the guy was just tickled that I, you know, that I got my life turned around. And she said, "Well, what's he going to have to do to be able to come back?" And he says, "You know, Mrs. Lewis," he said, "when I became district attorney, I knew that he had had enough. Because I did 18 months in New Mexico for two joints." And he said, "The first thing I did when I came into office was I took out his file and got rid of it."
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, I was good to go. And God doesn't do that kind of stuff without a reason. And I couldn't see myself coming back and, you know, getting a job and just going through life. I really felt a heavy calling on my life that I need to do something for God.
We'll have more with Gwen Lewis right after this reminder. It's just a nudge to remember the good work done by the American Red Cross. If you ever need an operation, you'll be glad that people donated blood to help you. So I want to remind you to give blood and to donate to the American Red Cross. They've been doing good for a long time. When my parents were prisoners of war, one of the things that saved their lives was a package they got from the Red Cross. Somewhere in the world today, there are people you can help through the Red Cross. Do yourself a favor. Give to the American Red Cross. Go to redcross.org. Thanks. We're back with Gwen Lewis, who got out of prison, went to seminary, and what do you do now?
Well, we were missionaries for 8 years in Colombia, South America, which is a neighboring country of where all this stuff happened. And I did church planting. We started a project for drug addicts, a rehabilitation project.
Working with people you knew.
Yeah, they were, you know, people that I had met there in Colombia.
Yeah.
And
but people like you in many ways, and that similar problems.
Exactly. And so I had a good understanding of what was involved in all that. And I knew that God could set people free from it. So we started a project in Medellin, which was at that time was the middle of the drug wars. And it was, you know, it was the center of the drug activity in Colombia. So there were a lot of young people strung out. So we started a program. And the guy that I had met there, I had met him doing prison work with him. And he became the center of that work. It's still going on today. They've seen tens of thousands of young people set free.
Hmm.
It's amazing. It's just absolutely amazing.
That must be gratifying to see that work continue.
Oh, it is. It is. Every time a young guy, we had street kids, prostitutes, thieves. We had so many testimonies. I ran out of places to tell them. It was just incredible what God was doing there. It really was amazing. We had a guy that was he was bipolar. He would lay on the street naked and push a tin can with his hand and crawl down the street begging. Hmm. We had him come into our church and receive the Lord and just got his whole life turned around. It was just incredible deliverance of this man. He became not normal, mm-hmm. but he could function. And he worked around the church. He did stuff for us, and he became a believer. I mean, we saw stuff like that all the time. We saw prostitutes getting saved. We saw, you know, sneak thieves, gamines. We call them gamines, street kids. It was just unbelievable what we saw mm-hmm. happening there, what God was doing.
And now you travel a lot.
Yeah. Well, what happened was I came back to the U.S., after Columbia, and we did church planting in Los Angeles. I was with a mega church down in Los Angeles, and they took me on as a missionary. The pastor told me, he said, "Okay, if Los Angeles was a foreign country and you were called to come here as a missionary, what would you do?" And so I said, "Oh, I'd start planting churches." He said, "Do it." And so we started planting churches. I, of course, my Spanish is really good.
Yes. Well practiced.
Yeah, I pastored one of the churches that we started, and started a couple others, and I also began a Filipino church and a Chinese church in Los Angeles.
Oh.
Just two people I had met. And then what happened was I started being invited to go to the Philippines, go to China, right? Because we're working with all these people. I was still going back to Latin America a little bit. We started a work in Guatemala. And so the pastor of the church, he said to me, he says, look, he said, you've got a lot more going than here at this local church. And actually, I was being not criticized, but people were wondering why I was never in my office at the church. I'm more of a front lines guy. I don't do well in offices. Uh-huh. And so the pastor of the church said it was time to figure something out.
I see.
And so the church helped me start a mission agency. Hmm. And so we started Sowers International. Mm-hmm. Is a mission agency. And now we're in 14 countries. We've got 66 full-time missionaries working under us. And I kind of go around and supervise all this work, do a lot of fundraising for the missionaries and the projects that they do, travel quite a bit to China, pretty heavily involved there in ministry, and just kind of keep it all rolling.
What's the best part of your job?
That. Going to China. Mm-hmm. China's just an amazing place. It's just, and I think it's because of the reason it's so amazing is because of the response. It's a few months ago, we had a group of people on a short-term mission trip that sat in a coffee shop on a university campus, and after 5 days had led over 60 students to Christ. And I mean, it was like with tears and joy, and it's just unbelievable. I mean, the kids are so hungry for God in China. They've been told their whole lives that there is no God, that the only thing you can count on is your government. And, you know, they know that that's empty, and they know that they're being lied to about that. And so there's this hunger for God. And it's just such a joy to be able to go in there and give them the truth.
So for people who share your belief system, if they wanted to follow you and become a head of their own missions program, what is your suggestion to them?
Just go for it. You know, I don't know. You see, the thing is that when we're in charge, it becomes difficult. But when God's in charge and he's the one doing all the moving, I just kind of sit back. I always tell people that my greatest gift is letting God do stuff, getting out of the way.
So you're saying that it was less planned than sitting down and actually deciding to do something?
Right. I never dreamt I would start a mission agency. I mean, it was not, you know, anything I had ever thought about. And then all of a sudden, it happened. You know, and God's using it. Our distinctive is that we only have like three non-foreign missionaries. We have three Westerners out of the 66. And that would be me and my son and one other guy in the Philippines. But my son and the other guy in the Philippines are both married to Filipinas, so...
So it's not people from one culture imposing their culture onto another one.
Well, it is, because like our whole staff in Thailand are all Filipinos. We have people in Colombia that are from Guatemala. So we still get that cross-cultural, cross-pollinization. I don't see it as depriving one culture of their culture. Mm-hmm. I see it as a cross-pollinization, that one third world person from Guatemala who has had a really tremendous experience with God and who's been able to improve their life is able to share that with a person from Colombia, which even though they speak Spanish, it's totally different culture. And the same with like our people from the Philippines that are in Thailand. And we have people from China that are in Central Asia working among Muslims. So there's that cross-cultural element is important.
Hmm. Some people would say that Christians should just mind their own business and stay within their own area and not be out doing this.
Well, that's, you know, I know a lot of people say that, but where we are, for example, we have an orphanage in a Muslim area of the Philippines. It's the only one that I've seen there in that area. There's no other place. we have Muslim kids who have come from worse than poor backgrounds. I mean, they're not just poor. I mean, they're sexually abused. They've been beaten. They're usually the result of either the parents who die or who are strung out on drugs and have abandoned them, and they're taken care of by their extended families and get abused. And I mean, it's horrible stories that I hear. And there's the Christians sticking their heads in where they're not supposed to, rescuing these children from these places, taking them to a clean, thriving facility and giving them a life. If that's sticking your head in where you don't belong, you're going to have to explain it to me because I don't get it.
So the counter to the criticism is that you're doing good work.
Amen. Mm-hmm. That's part of the gospel. I mean, you know, it's... And I hear that a lot, but you know, you get that everywhere. And what do you think? What do you think the terrorists are doing?
Well, I think it's the difference between the idea that you are sharing a philosophical idea, as opposed to, you know, and you're just trying to change people's minds, where you're actually doing something helpful and beneficial for in a practical way for people.
Yeah, but see, in my opinion, sharing the gospel with an adult is just as important as taking a kid from a crummy situation and putting them in a really nice family orphanage.
Right. You see them as intertwined.
Yes, absolutely. And, mm-hmm. you know, I China was invaded around AD 1000 by Buddhist missionaries. I mean, we're not doing anything that hasn't already been done. You know,
it's not uncommon in world history.
And, you know, I think... you know, our Christian missionaries have the idea of not destroying culture. As a matter of fact, I think Christian missionaries, just all the ones I know, are better trained culturally in cross-cultural communication than anybody else. You look at the business world, and these guys, they need some cross-cultural education, man. They're making big mistakes. And as far as I know, the missionaries that I know within our organization and others, they have some really good cultural sensitivity training. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know what's good in the culture, but we also know there are some things that are bad in the culture. I mean, if having extramarital sex with anybody that comes along, we would stand against that, and not just because it's in the Bible, but because it's bad for people. You're going to catch something, and you're going to complicate your life, and you're going to have kids all over the place that have no mother and father, have no family to live with. It's just a bad idea. And we have, you know, the Bible has a solution for AIDS. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you knew that or not, but there's a solution for AIDS in the Bible. They got scientists working on this all over the place. They're spending billions of dollars looking for a cure for AIDS. But it's in the Bible. The one man, one woman.
It does slow down the progression of the disease.
It certainly does. I mean, theoretically, if everybody followed that, it wouldn't be AIDS.
When you need to provide yourself with self-motivation, how do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
I do things like, for example, I'm a real wuss at studying the Bible every day.
A missionary who doesn't study the Bible every day?
Yes. Sometimes I just, you know, it's like going on a diet or something. It's just really I'm really bad at that. So what I do is I manipulate myself to have to do it. Like I volunteer to teach and I volunteer to preach so that I have to do it. Because if I don't, I know I'm a wuss and I'll probably, you know, bag it. And you know, the other thing is that when I go to our orphanage in the Philippines, for example, and these kids run up, that's pretty motivating.
Yeah. When you need to calm yourself, what do you do to soothe yourself?
Oh, gosh. I read a lot. And I travel quite a bit. I have to, you know, I go around to all the places where we have work. Well, not all of them. In Asia, I travel to Asia mostly. I don't do Latin America anymore. We have another person that does that. But I travel quite a bit, and so I read a lot because there's a lot of downtime. Mm-hmm. And so I read. I read junk. I love these page-turner mystery books, you know. And so I read those. I read inspirational books. There's some really good stuff out there written by pastors and missionaries. When I'm here in the U.S., my favorite thing to do is watch basketball. I love basketball. I love to watch. And so I got a huge big screen TV, and I got it with air miles, right? Free for air miles. And I have the NBA season ticket, so I get all the games. So I just on the couch and watch a basketball game. That really settles my spirit.
There you go. My last question for you. If you were giving a commencement speech for high school or college, what would be your best advice?
Gosh, to try to, you know, to involve people in your decision-making process. I pretty much just made all my decisions on my own, and they were horrible. I made some really, really dumb decisions. And, you know, looking back, it's just, my life could have been so much easier had I had a group of people around me that were healthy. They were helping me make decisions. You know, it's like when I speak with high school kids about drugs, I get that assignment a lot. Tell them, I say, hey, you know, drugs make you feel great. Mm-hmm. They do. I mean, why? I'm not going to lie to you. They do. They make you feel great. I mean, you smoke that joint. Ooh, man, it makes you feel good. You start laughing. Everything's funny. You get hungry. You know, it makes you feel really good. The problem is, what comes after that? It complicates your life. All you do is smoking marijuana, but you're in college. Next thing you know, you're not too interested in school anymore. You're not too interested in your family anymore. All you want to do is get some more marijuana, you know, have some fun, giggle, and get hungry. The drug itself makes you feel good for a short time, but the consequences, the complications that come into your life as a result are devastating. I mean, even with marijuana, they're devastating. You become, you know, self-indulgent. You lose your feelings for other people. You fail to participate with others that don't smoke. And then you get involved with just with people that do that. I mean, they're so stoned all the time. What can they do? I mean, they lay around and giggle. I mean, it doesn't get you anywhere. And yeah, I hear the argument, especially from people that smoke dope. You know, well, you know, marijuana is not as dangerous as chewing gum. And, you know, I always tell them, like, what would you rather do, drown or burn to death? Taking two things that are bad and then comparing them to each other. Compare marijuana with nothing at all. Come on, be honest.
I want to thank Gwen Lewis for the time. Thank you very much. I appreciate your help.
Okay, sure enough. Thank you.